We'll try and draw a full-size drawing of it to get a feeling of it full-size. In the old days, we used to do it with pencil and erasers and sweeps. Mm-hmm. Now they do it with tape. It's a lot faster. Mm-hmm. I don't think quite as good. And you try to put a little perspective in the tape drawing or make a little in-view drawing to kind of feel your way around. And, of course, you've got a package you're working with which establishes glass planes and the limits of the vehicle, width and length. Mm-hmm. You know where some of the wheels are. You know where the air cleaner is, where the people sit. Now, with government regulations, you got a lot more stuff than that. But you begin to box the thing in clay. I drag the glass planes in first. That's getting a little more difficult as you get cars like a Topaz or a Tempo, where the glass planes really evolve from the shape, and you just kind of draw lines on a compound shape. Mm-hmm. And then you can drag in the widths, just rough. And then you start hacking. Do you get it right? And it is work. Mm-hmm. It never comes easy. Once in a while, very great while, does it happen fast. But usually you do it again and again, give up, do it again. And a good designer works until that car is right. And I don't think they do as much of that as they should anymore. You know, you want to get all the warped surfaces out of it, the twists, the bad highlights. You want things to flow through the proper way. You want the proportion to look like the car sits comfortably. A lot of people don't understand that. And, you know, if you make a short deck, it should be higher, usually, because the mass is needed there. I don't know why, except it looks funny if it isn't. So it evolves that way. You make the clay model. You get it approved. Then you start on the models that evolve from it, like a two-door or a four-door or a station wagon or whatever. You make the studio models out of fiberglass. And you make a feasibility model so that you work every nitpicking thing out of that car with body engineering, with assembly people and all of that. And that's tedious. Because you do the inside and the outside. We model the full interior, you know, mm-hmm. billboards, we call them. Mm-hmm. And even the assembly procedure gets into that. This goes on, then that goes on, then the screw goes on, and this overlaps that, and this is undercut under that. Mm-hmm. We model all that, work it all out. Mm-hmm. And you have to work with the metal stamping people on all the stampings. And it isn't just a matter of making it as round as they want it or as soft as they want it. It's a matter of arm twisting a little and getting what you want, and not ruining the Woodhaven stamping plant, mm-hmm. getting the guy to go the full limit for you. And I found throughout the company that body engineering people and metal stamping people respect you if you're not stupid. Mm-hmm. And if you will work with them, compromise, try, and still hang on to what you want. But if you just say, nope, that's it. And that's what Joe Orris used to do. Mm-hmm. He'd make a fool out of you because he would stop the whole company until somebody way up high 6 weeks later made him give in. And that's not being very bright. And all those respected guys down at Woodhaven, or I haven't had that much luck with the plastics people from Saline. Nobody gets along with them.
Why is that?
I think they're too new. And they're going to make that Saline plant work properly, no matter what happens to you and the rest of the company. I always got that feeling. And they've stopped a few things that were really bad. But after you get the thing feasible and you release the whole mess, now the designers have to chase it all through the system. Have to sign off on every die model. Have to sign off on the cube, and this is interior and exterior. Have to sign off on all the seats, the build-ups, seats, and all the fabrics, all the colors, all the matching colors. And then we chase them through the plants now. Go down there and live in Louisville for 6 weeks in August. Not very nice. Live in a trailer. That isn't what they taught us in design school. They didn't say that would happen.
In this process, how do the product planners Where?
I went in the hallway and I battled with him. You have to. You're put in a situation where they want it to be cheap, the lower level product planners. The upper level ones are smart enough to know it can't be just cheap. And you have to cajole, sell, connive, hope, pray that you get through the system what you really want to get through. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. After that, the planners, they're with you most of the time. Not everything. They're into your hair.
Mm-hmm.
I belong with some of them. Some of them I didn't. You get some of these, what we used to call 90-day wonders, that, you know, they're geniuses. They absolutely are. I mean, they're all the top of their class at Harvard or wherever. Impressive. Boy, stats, facts, figures, information, work, they're great. But they run up one road only. They don't see anything except where they're going. And some of them are rather limited, and they really don't get very far after a while, even though they're geniuses. The ones that take in more of the company in their thinking tend to go further. I was like Jack Eby.
Mm-hmm.
And Jimmy Funk over Truck now, he's thinking that way, and Hal Sperlich thought that way, and Dick Kimball when he was over in product planning. The good ones see your point of view. But it's tough to get a car from start to finish, and after 35 years, I got tired of pulling them through a hole in the floor, you know, just
single-handed. What about the engineering input in that process?
Well, again, you run into the engineer who just can't do it anyway but this, period. And I got a little blunt with them, and most of them, I think, respected me because I was trying to figure it out. Joe Orris would just say, no, I want it this way. And that, you know, that headbutting gets you nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And if they saw you were really making an effort to try to figure it out, they'd respect you for it. And I never had any terrible battles with Body except some dummies that were down low and would attend meetings and say dumb things like, we won't make the car. You know, that's foolishness.
You had a few of those.
Oh, yeah. Especially from the saloon plastics people. And they always came, they came in 2 weeks before the Escort was produced and said, we can't make it. It's impossible, it's not feasible.
Really?
Now, would you do that? The headlamp door, they couldn't chrome plate them. I mean, crepe hangers. There's always a certain group that likes to go to a meeting and tell about disaster. There's always one of those. Out of 20 guys, there'll be one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And lately, it's been from the climate control group.
Ah. Oh.
They came in with an arrangement for the new van that was bigger than the van,
mm-hmm.
in order to cool it. I mean, it looked like a Franklin stove sitting in the back. And they, that's it. That's the best we can do. Well, that's stupid. And there are groups, and you wonder, they come in way late in a program, and you say, where have you been? And they just don't seem to bother them.
The Tempo Topaz group seems to have succeeded fairly well.
Yeah, there was some things wrong with the car.
Yeah,
I give Fritzy and Dave Turner almost full credit for that.
Fritzy.
Mayhew.
Mayhew, yes, right.
It was down in my studio, but there was a political battle going on at the time. I pushed it along and helped it happen.
Mm-hmm.
I hope it works out. I've got one, but it's got things wrong with it.
There are some bugs in there,
yeah. Instrument panel rattles. Engine bucks on acceleration. Back seat is terrible.
Can you
mind expanding on the on that episode in your career?
What, the tempo
tempo thing?
Well,
see, that thing started.
Well, we were working on a car that was that car,
mm-hmm.
under Borden A.
Yeah.
And I was sent into that studio after it had been started, and it was just another Lincoln downsized. It was awful. Straight fenders and I'd say 10-year-old styling. And Gene was wrong. And I got caught on the wrong team in there, working on Gene's car. Telnak came in, and he had to do something. So he grabbed Fritz and said, do this one this way. Well, it left me over there working on the one I didn't want to work on. And Fritz knew that, and Jack did too. And I didn't know how to step around that place without stepping into it. I tried to put a little curve on the fender, and Gene would come in, what are you doing? What are you doing? And he got desperate. And we finally did a fairly good car. It sort of got approved. And then Jack had Fritz do another one. It was a little more exaggerated, and that's the one that's on the road. And I don't think Jack was wrong at all, but he was in a terrible situation with Gene still in there. It was really bad. The modelers, the poor modelers, didn't know who to listen to.
Jack was sort of brought in to counter the influence of a fading vice president.
He was a fair-haired boy. I remember when Jack went to Europe. He worked for me at the time, and he asked me, should I go? I said, Jack, I didn't go, and it hurt me. You go. And he complained about moving and this and that. I said, go. And it made him. He came back friends with vice presidents and so on, and they pushed him right up there.
You think he's just fine?
Well, he's been good for the cars. I think Jack's very nervous. I worry about his health. I don't think he can run the whole thing when it finally lands on him. And when they decide whether Kafka's the boss or Jack's the boss. Jack looks a lot older than he did a couple of years ago. It's a terrible pressure. Especially when he's got Don Peterson and Kafka over here, and Jack's got all the responsibility and Kafka's getting all the attention. It's weird.
It's a very strange division of authority. When did that happen?
Right away, when Jack was brought in.
I see.
So he's not a VP, and Kafka is.
Uh-huh.
And Kafka's got 40 people working for him and no responsibility.
But he's largely in advance, isn't he?
Yeah, but he's doing nothing except funny-looking cars. And Jack's got all the company's products to do. I don't understand it.
I wonder how that happened.
I really don't want to promote him that fast. They don't think he's steady enough.
He's obviously a very talented designer.
He's talented. He's very able to present his case. He'll flip-flop a little. I worry about him if he gets handed the whole thing. It may be too much.
Do you see a... Can you see a thread going through the history of Ford design that, or is it a series of fits and starts?
Fits and starts, chaos, upheaval, reorganizations, new leaders, new bright geniuses, and then they fade, and another one, and they fade, and another one. Gene kind of stayed steadily through the years for what he was there through it all, somehow.
Both you and John Ajar are admirers of Gene's tenacity.
Yeah, it's amazing. I don't know how he lived through it. I don't know how his stomach lived through it. Why they shot at him with everything there is. I don't agree with his design ideas the last 7 or 8 years particularly. He amazed me with his hanging in there.
Your tenure as director of the design studio, was that a pleasant time for you, the early 70s?
As a director? It was for a while, until I began to feel they didn't want me. Very devastating the last year. because I never was told what was happening.
How did that manifest itself?
Trying to think back. Del had me transferred to the Ford studio. He promoted me in the Advanced studio, De La Rosa.
Yes.
I did something in Europe that got him upset.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what it was to this day.
You had a year in Europe?
No, I went over there to check on some cars they were building at Ghia. Mm-hmm. At that time, it wasn't Ghia. It was whatever the guy's name is. And I found some really improprieties over there.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt I told people about it. And there were mega thousands being stolen. And something happened when I got back, and I got transferred into the Ford studio and ran it for 3 or 4 years. Had a fairly good relationship with product planning. Somebody didn't like me. I don't know whether it was Lee Iacocca or somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember. Got along very well with Jack Eby. But he was the guy that ran all the product planning at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The poor man had all the car lines. Can you imagine that? Mm-hmm. And they wonder why he failed? And Jack got blamed for the no engines that all of a sudden
mm-hmm.
happened.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the poor man couldn't handle it. I don't know, I had a good relationship with Jim Capilongo in truck.
You seem to have been happy there.
I like Jim.
Mm-hmm.
He's a reasonable man.
Yeah.
And you could talk to him. And if he didn't agree with you, fine, but at least he wasn't on a different plane.
But some of the things that came out of that era in Ford Design have been rather striking. The Ranger,
John had a lot to do with the Ranger. The Ranger truck, to me, isn't advanced enough. I think it's going to get old very quick.
It's just an interim.
Right piece. I think they should have taken another step.
Mm-hmm. Which would been what?
Well, a little more contemporary style. It's really ape the big truck just too much, and
mm-hmm.
it's all kind of pieces put together like truck always did.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they should have made the next step so it would last a little longer. A little Chevy is a little more unique design. Not as good a truck, but
the S10.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It's got more of a flush-looking cab and bigger wheels. Longer box. There were some product planning mistakes on the Ranger, I can't believe.
Really?
Box is too narrow, and they only got a 7-foot long box.
It does look a bit odd.
The S10 has a 8-foot box. It's killing them.
Mm-hmm.
And they got the shift in the wrong place and things like that.
Aren't they bringing out a larger box?
I don't think they could put an 8-foot box on that thing.
What's the next generation of truck design?
Well, I think they should make a much more contemporary cab with many more car-like features. More comfort, better seating, a little more room so you can tilt the seats back somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
High-tech instrument panel, more car-like. Smoother external surfaces for better aerodynamics.
Is this coming to you?
They're stuck with that Ranger for quite a while.
Really?
Even them mucking around with it, facelifted, things like that.
For the next 2-3 years, at
least. I don't think they made a big enough step when they did it. It's a good little truck,
mm-hmm.
selling very well and doing fine, but I think they would have been better to go a little further out. I guess most designers say that.
What do you feel has been, now again, stop me if I go too far, your main contribution to the history of Ford design? Not in any self-serving way, but a
specific car?
No, not necessarily, unless you want to speak to that.
No, just making sure what I was working on was high quality. I just mm-hmm. tried the darndest to make it right,
mm-hmm.
as best I could. And you pull some miracles off from time to time, and you get lucky from time to time, and you have some terrible times. I kept a car, and the clay model is still kidding me. Gene came in and said, the 58 Chevy is a big, fat car. We got to do a big, fat car. So I did a big, fat Lincoln, thinking 58 Chevy. It was dreadful, and it was green. And we hauled it out in the courtyard, and it lasted 4 hours before somebody broke it up. Nobody ever let me forget that thing. It was an embarrassment. I did a lot of show cars I'm very proud of.
Do you mind mentioning a couple of them?
Well, that Bordenay Cobra that was published.
Oh, yeah.
I did that car.
Did you? That was yours from the beginning?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I did it in the basement. I did a couple other sports cars that Edsel Ford went bonkers over. Mm-hmm. I don't know what happened to them. I'm trying to think back. Boy. I worked on some cars that weren't bad. 68 Torinos, 72 Torinos. 72 was a nice car model.
Mm-hmm.
And Lou Iacocca bought it. And then Knutson watched over it when it got feasibilized and came in with a bunch of General Motors rules. The front fender must be higher over the front wheel than the line is back over the belt. So they took the fender and ballooned it, and the whole car got fat. And I went over there and watched the Fies model develop, and people said, oh no, they're doing your car. Well, they ruined it. That hurt. Because it was a rather good looking, originally the clay model was good.
Which was that again?
72 Torino.
72 Torino.
Turned out to be a bad car, rusted and didn't have bumpers. And
did you have any input into the Falcon?
No, I worked a little on it, facelifted it a couple of times. I did the 63 Falcon, one with a long, I did that car.
Mm-hmm.
We put the little Freddy roof on it, they called it at the time, a little hardtop.
Mm-hmm.
That was a good looking car for its day. I made a Comet out of it, which was not good. It had some kind of funny boxy front fender.
I think I had one of those ones. 68?
I worked on the 61 Lincolns. I always liked them. All those small Lincolns, I thought, were kind of nice. The worst monster the company ever made was that big Lincoln, the crazy one that was so long that it rippled as it went down the road.
What year was that?
I'm trying to think of it. Najar worked on that.
Yeah.
La Rosa.
I think so.
Worst car in history, I think.
Yeah.
That would have been the...
Huge. The biggest Lincoln ever made.
63?
Had big fenders like this.
58, too.
57 was a rather good-looking car.
It's been the 58.
58 had a fin put on it. Mm-hmm. It was a 57. This was an all-new, the largest integral frame car that was ever made. And it did. It went over the road this way.
Undulated.
It undulated. I can't remember what year that was. It was terrible.
Looking back, you probably have more pluses than minuses, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah. I could live through any of it, except I have a feeling of doing hard time when it came to working for Joe Orr's.
Mm-hmm.
Just awful.
Mm-hmm. The... How could that have survived?
He's such a hard worker.
Mm-hmm.
And people believed in him, and he did everything the hard way. He did 30 of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable. Just, I can't even talk about it. It's so painful.
Mm-hmm. But you did get into the design studio as director, and that must have been interesting. 4 or 5 years.
Right. I thought I was going somewhere. I don't think, personally, as I look back on it, I was really ready to handle the types of Lee Iacocca or Don Peterson or mm-hmm. Mr. Ford one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
I was a little uneasy. Perhaps they felt that.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't my forte.
How do you feel that HF2, what was his... impact on design history?
I always admired the man. Mm-hmm. Because he said what he wanted to say, and he did pull this place up out of Greece.
Mm-hmm.
He worked hard.
Mm-hmm.
You can never fault the rich man that works hard.
Right.
Bill's the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And young Bill's the same way, by mm-hmm. the way. The kids are nice. Edsel's a nice guy.
Very hard workers.
And they're trying to do good.
Mm-hmm.
I think Henry got a little lost the last few years when the downsizing hit and the oil embargo hit and the real problems came about. I thought he thought that it was going to go away and the big Ford was going to continue.
Was going to survive.
Yeah, I really don't think he, toward the end, was up with it as much as he should have been.
In effect, he was right, but he was 5 years too late.
Yeah, but he couldn't see the real problem coming where we'd need new engines and tremendous improvement in gas economy and things like that. He really couldn't see it, I don't think.
Do you think the rivalry with Iacocca may have obscured his vision somewhat?
I don't know what happened there. I got a little involved in it, and there was some personal problems there that were very interesting. And Lee, of course, was a strong personality, and I think Henry thought he was going to run away with the company when he left.
Mm-hmm.
And something happened with the big Ford airplane and Lee and Mrs. Ford,
mm-hmm.
about them using it for idle uses, mm-hmm. and bang, it went away. I got a trip on the thing to L.A., I remember, with five of us. And I was coming back from Los Angeles, sitting there being served an omelet with champagne,
mm-hmm.
with the black fellow that was the football star from Yale over here. I think was his name, All-American.
And Personnel.
Over there in Glass House.
Mm-hmm.
I said to him, whatever his name was, I said, God, this is ridiculous. He says, yeah, it is. I said, I feel like the Shah of Iran. And Henry sold the airplane to the Shah of Iran the next day. I couldn't believe that circumstance.
I suppose that, that if I were to ask you, as I'm going to, if you could give me the highlights in Ford design history, as you experienced them and saw them, what do you think they would be? Or better, the whole, can you sum up in a pithy paragraph or two the experience of working at Ford in design?
Well, of course, as I said, it was never dull.
Mm-hmm.
And the people there, I think, were superior to any other design group, no matter what they were designing, anywhere in the world. If you told them to build anything, they'd do it. And it was a marvelous atmosphere to work in because of all that genius that you touched every day. And I always felt Ford contributed more innovative designs in the car place, whether it's just show cars or cars, than anybody else, because they were less involved in a corporate system that was so tightly held down. And that was one benefit of the upset.
Mm-hmm.
But the most awful part of it was we always had to sell our designs to somebody unqualified to buy them.
Mm-hmm.
And that hurt Ford products time after time.
Mm-hmm. This is obviously the complaint of many, many talented designers.
Oh, it's a problem any designer has, or an actor who complains about the producer or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But at Ford, it was particularly bad, and now you used to have to deal with just Lee or just somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Now you deal with armies of these people that invade your studio before you're ready.
Mm-hmm.
The marketing people, and then the product planning people, and then the cost people, and then the cost people from World Headquarters, and then Mr. Caldwell, and then somebody else, and then somebody else. And you just get battered to death.
Mm-hmm.
It's sure enough, sooner or later, you get weary and just get it out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too much, as a designer, takes too much of your strength.
Mm-hmm.
You spend 10% of your effort designing and the rest of the time protecting. And that's not right, in my view.
Did you have to, protecting interests me. What do you mean by protecting?
Keeping them from wrecking it,
mm-hmm.
Changing it, forcing you to do things you don't want to do. Because they've got the ear to the people back in the glass house now. When Gene left, the floodgates opened.
Really?
Oh, Lordy.
He had held them at bay.
He certainly had.
Over a decade or so.
They gave him full marks for that.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're just waiting to get in there. Oh, Lordy. I spent the last year doing nothing but budgets. Why the heck should I be doing a budget? I don't understand it. I'm not good at them. And I would write three or four, and all the financial people would do would be to tell me it's wrong. Go do another one. Well, that's like a fly trying to get out of the window. You know, frustration.
This still obtains, in your view, at Ford?
Oh, yeah, it's worse.
It's worse.
They can't fight them off. You may be a big, strong person, but if there's a pack of dogs... I got tired.
You resigned.
Yeah.
Did you feel you were ready to go? Did you feel like you wanted to go?
Well, I wasn't financially ready.
Yeah.
It's hurt me. But I haven't regretted it. I had some good experiences, and a lot of good experiences toward the end with outside people. I suppose I go get a job. I haven't yet.
What have you been doing in retirement?
Nothing much. Playing golf, running my boat, flying,
traveling. Still flying?
I may do something. I'm moving right now, so I can't do anything.
What would you think that Ford could do to remedy the situation as you see it?
They've got to keep the vultures out of the design center. They've got to close the gates and restrict who has an imprint on the product when he shouldn't have. They've got to stop believing survey material verbatim. And they've got to settle the organization so there's a man in charge. They've got to do those things.
And beyond that?
Well, the total company worries me because they're worried too much about financial things and not about the product. I never felt that Henry Ford, the first, I don't think he ever felt about that he was in business to make a profit. I'd argue with Mr. Caldwell, that's not why we're in business. The original Mr. Ford was in business to get every farmer a tractor and every family a car. And I think that's what was in his mind. He was not, if he made money, wonderful. But I don't think he started out to make money. I think he started out to make a car. I think they got the cart before the horse here now.
That's the bottom line.
I think a good product will beget the money. But when you start out trying to cost everything out ahead of time and cost every proposal, you just stagnate the system and you get what I said before, paralysis by analysis. And that's what the company suffers from.
That's a good slogan.
It is unbelievable what goes on. Every proposal gets costed, analyzed, surveyed. Boy, that takes armies of people. And statistics, you wouldn't believe it. Another thing they should do immediately is eliminate the performance review. Ruining the Ford Motor Company.
The product or the personal?
The personal performance review. If you're the plant manager at Louisville, you write your own goals down now. Let's say you write down 175 trucks an hour. I'll be good boy, that's what I'll do. And it comes time to produce the trucks, and you can only make 155 an hour if you make them right. But that means you're a failure. So you make 175 an hour, even though they're bad trucks. And this is happening all over that company. And it's wrong.
Is the whistleblower extinct?
No. I'm not sure he gets listened to. I was impressed by some of the union people that stopped things from time to time and talked to people like Jim Capilongo on the line, came right up and said, hey. And Jim happens to be the personality that would listen. But I worry about some of these other people. I think the personnel organization and the financial organization are running the company. And the personnel people make the company fit a personnel idea of what a company is, and it promotes personnel. And it doesn't matter what they do, really.
So you've got a hydra-headed monster, really.
I just think they've lost sight of their basic goal.
Which is?
Make cars.
And make good ones.
Right. Then the money will come.
Well, it's been most stimulating.
Well, it can't get me fired.
Kenneth Spencer. And we are very appreciative of your
I appreciate it. But you'll note I danced around trying to take credit for anything. I have a fellow that worked for me for several years who lives in Boca Raton. And I'd go down there once a year and pick up the newspaper. And lo and behold, he's the designer of another car that somebody else worked on. And I'm quite peeved about it.
Mm-hmm.
It really bothers me. Because none of us did the whole car. Mm-hmm. Even a couple of those show cars that I did do all by myself.
We're not one man show.
Marty Herbel or Bob Thacker or somebody helped me. The clay modeler did it. You know, I don't buy that. It's like the pitcher that says, I won the game.
Mm-hmm.
Those other eight guys weren't there, he wouldn't have won the game.
Well, thank you, Ken Spencer.
Appreciate it.
Very good of you.
Bakken. It's November 10th, 1981. We're continuing our second interview with John Nanger, who retired from the Ford Motor Company from the design department. The first interview had, well, sort of taken John's life and his family, given an overview of his early life, and took design work at the Ford Motor Company up into the 1930s. One of the things that we had talked about the last time, I guess it was about a week or so ago, was sort of the philosophy of design and how that has changed over the years at the Ford Motor Company. And so on his own, John went home and thought about this and his sort of, with the help of some documents, which we can number and identify, he's tried to sketch this out, and we're going to talk about it now. And in a way, try to, as much as one can, to pin down the styling or the design philosophy of the company and how it changed over the years, how it reacted to product changes, how it reacted to the war, and how it reacted to different people. And that's what we want to talk about today. So, John, I wonder if we can start out and go through this, or do you want to issue some kind
sure.
of opening statement?
Well, basically, I think it's better if we just stumble into it.
Okay.
I don't know if it can be as pure as saying design philosophy at Ford Motor Company. We may have to ramble a bit here. But I've created these 10 or 15 sheets of paper which give an overview or a cursory look at automotive design from about the 1920s up to the present and a little push into the future.
Okay. Why don't we just call this kind of Exhibit A then, and then we can, any kind of sheet
absolutely.
That we have to identify, we can subdivide.
That's fine.
Okay.
The whole we flip over the first sheet, and it has on it 1920, 30, 40, and 50, and after each of those 10-year periods are a side view of an automobile and a front view. And of course, in the 20s, the Model T, in its late derivatives, as far as Ford Motor Company is concerned, were the predominant automobile. I just put these down to refresh our memory. In the 30, it showed a little softer look at the vehicles. But let me jump around. This first page shows the 20, 30, 40s, and 50s.
Uh-huh.
The next page pulls it up into the 50 pluses. I should have made that 55 plus, because the 55 plus was a significant change in design philosophy, and we'll get back to that. And the page goes on to 60, 70, and to the 80s. And these are just little vignette pictures.
Okay.
And we'll flip that over. Now we come down to the detail shots. On these, it describes the 20s, and very briefly in one-line statements. The 20s were basically straight-line elements on the vehicles, and those and very few compound surface, and this was a part of the profession at the time. No big tools were being made to press out the sharp form, so therefore the straight-line elements were wrapped, flat pieces of metal. The metal, of course, was thick enough, so it didn't have to be stretched to take a set. As cars went on, as we'll see as we go on, they used thinner and thinner metal to reduce the weight, and that metal had to be formed or curved, bowed to give it its strength, so it wouldn't oil can, so to speak.
Sure. When we talk about metal, what was the predominant metal?
As far as I know for myself, it was steel.
Steel.
And then, of course, there were casting. Ford Motor Company, throughout the years and right up to current time, has been known for good quality of its metal in its vehicle. Not necessarily sheet metal, but in the forgings in the underpart, where they use the brake arms and things of that nature, they'd go to forging, whereas our competitors would use stamped steel parts. Uh-huh. And Ford got quite a good reputation that way. The other design element that you note in this side view is that the roof profile, it's higher in the back than it is at the front. And this will continue on for a few years. And the reason for that partly was that the car, the vehicle, had wheels, it had axles on top of that, and it had a straight frame, and on top of that straight frame sat a rather high seat. Mm-hmm. Whereas the little engine was way out in front, and it was just natural to bring the windshield down. The other thing is that the engine is located just after the front axle in profile view, and the radiator was a vertical line again. Again, this very boxy straight line element.
Uh-huh.
And the rear passengers on the sedan types of vehicles sat directly over the rear axle, projecting the roof up even higher. Now, looking at this basic silhouette or basic shape in front view, the vehicle was just wide enough to accommodate two passengers. Then the doors came down to that frame, and then stuck on the outside of that were the front and rear fenders. There were no fixed side windows, and the spare tire was exposed. And then the headlamps and tail lamps were stuck on as separate elements. Now, to me, those are design principles.
Uh-huh.
They were not necessarily designed by designer per se, but they grew.
The headlamps and tail lamps, they were separate because at first they were independent. They weren't hooked into the auto.
That's right. They were formerly on the cowl in further times, and these were things you could buy separately, have them shipped in.
Uh-huh.
Then we move to the 30s, and the surfaces become rounder. Let me just say, instead of sharp corners, those corners turn into round, into radii, and then the use of compound surfaces increase. It's in the fenders and into the roof and into the hood. Still, the roof profile is higher at the rear, and now what's happened is, again, the differential is directly underneath the rear seat passenger, and he has to get on top of that, and he is basically high. So I asked one of my mentors at Ford when I was a young man, the clay modeling guy by the name of Richard Bonnike. I says, "Hey, Dick, how come on our cars the roof is always higher in the back?" He said, "Well, that's real simple, John." I said, "Why that?" He said, "So the people in the back can look over the shoulders of the people in the front." And I don't know if that was true or not, but
it
all went up on the, Here in the 30s, the engine started to move forward. The frame started to lower a little bit between the front and rear axle. There was a desire to get the center of gravity down on the vehicle, and they were doing it a couple of ways. One was lowering the passengers, and when they lowered the passengers slightly, they had to shove the engine forward to start making for the front feet of the passengers, forward passengers' front feet. And then they started to make the vehicle slightly wider, and you could squeeze in three people.
Mm-hmm.
But they still came back, and they still applied the fenders onto the thing. Now they have completely enclosed the vehicle. And the spare tires were still mounted externally, and as I've indicated here, overall height was reduced and the length was increased somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
Then into the 40s, surfaces became fully compound now. Straight elements, straight line elements were becoming a thing of the past. The roof profile started to come down, so it was starting to be more of a straight line. It still hadn't had that racy feeling where the roof profile trails off toward the back. The wheel openings, around the wheel openings, instead of flying fenders, were now starting to be closed in, so you couldn't see all the running gear, and then it also had a good purpose of covering up the mud from flying out. But in this period, the frame again was lowered between the front and rear axle, and the engine was moved further forward, making more room for the passengers to move forward, and as a result of this, the rear seat passengers seat could drop, and which brought the roof down with it. And now the body width is increased a little bit more, and there is ample room for three passengers. Significantly in this area, The windshield was angled aft with a purpose and V'd in plan view. One was to reduce the inside reflections that you received. If you were wearing a white shirt on the cars previous to this area, you could see your white shirt reflected in the windshield of the vehicle. It was hard to see through it. Two, and when they're starting to stamp these steel roofs now, and they're stretched all the way from the back of the car to the front, angling the windshield back at the top reduced the blank size of the sheet metal that they had to use to hit that area. So there was another purpose. And now the running boards are starting to be covered or gradually reduced in width as the body got wider.
Okay.
And now into the beginning 50s, again, we are already into fully compound surface, and the fenders now and the body become one. The body moved outboard to the full width, and now the fenders connected with the front door and the rear quarter panel or rear fenders connected with the rear door. So in plan view, the vehicle became one line. One piece curved windshields and backlights were introduced in this time in order to make the vehicle look wider and minimize the number of pieces that had to be installed. You can imagine when you had to have on the windshield two separate pieces with a divider bar in the center, it was easier to put in the one piece.
Sure.
So it became just more economical as well as looking better to do it that way. In this period, again, the engine, I don't know that it was definitely moved forward any further over the front axle, but the frame was dropped further, allowing the passengers to sink a little bit lower, bring the roof down, and now for the first time, the 50s started to indicate you could have the roof go from the front seat driver toward the back in any fashion you want. You could have a drop off as smooth as you want, or you could close couple the rear passengers to make a nice little sedan. Let's see now. The door sills now, the running boards are now gone, and you just have the scuff plates about 2 to 3 inches wide or door sills, and the headlamps and tail lamps are fully integrated into the body surfaces. Again, a cost-saving factor. You punch a hole in the fenders and just plunk in the light. You don't have to mount them separately. Now, the 50 pluses, the 55 plus specifically, from 55 to, let's say, 58 or 59. The designers, I don't know where it started, whether it started in fashion or in the automotive industry or in the aircraft industry or the introduction of the rocketry program starting up, but automobile designers started to figure that, well, fins and a lot of flying surfaces and lines that float any place on the car was the thing to do. I think that was the period where you could say they were not automobile designers, but they were truly stylists, putting shapes on things that not always had perfect function. And so I put down here just listed words. Extravagantly fashioned body contours were abounded. We experienced full exploration of wrapped windshields. The windshields wrapped all the way around to the side. They had reverse A-pillars at the end of the windshield. Made it a little hard to get in the vehicle. We had increased front and rear overhangs, increasing the length of the vehicle. Everything was exaggerated. And the vehicles became, the name of the game became the lowest and longest and widest vehicle. So this just simply tries to show that in a simple cartoon. Then the 60s hit, and the public, by their reaction, and some of the designers and the gray heads of the group prevailed and said, let's cut this stuff out now. And I started to get back to design for automotive beauty in itself. And simpler lines started to come in, lines that were tailored and ran from the front to the rear in a clean or singly broken line that hopped up into a modified fin. And during this period, the vehicles went up a little bit, in fact. The overall height went up slightly, provide better room for entry and egress. We had pulled them down so far in the late 50s that we had to go back up to make it palatable for people to now get into and comfortable room in the rear seat. So, and it was during the 60s that we started to get some super special vehicles. I don't mean to say we didn't have specialty vehicles like the Thunderbirds and the Corvettes before that, but we started to pick up cars for the public in the 60s, like the Mustang, which is one of the notable ones that came up. The Falcon was in there. And then we get into the 70s. And in this, there were two significant things that happened in there. Obviously, the gasoline shortage, and then the government mandates. It was felt that the automobile industry would not introduce those things that were required soon enough. And during that period, the company, even though the movement by the ecologists, let's say, happened in the late 60s, the impact in design happened in 70 because of the lead time in taking. So what we had done was to start to reduce the size of the vehicle because of the enormous tooling costs, so we just simply couldn't throw away all the tools that we had, all the platforms, the frames that we had, all the running gears, so it had to be done on a gradual basis, at least as far as Ford Motor Company was concerned. Yeah. So we saw when a body or a vehicle was to have a facelift, minor modifications to it, or a complete change at that time, we would take and make the effort to reduce the sheet metal sizes, make the vehicles more compact. Remember, we're still talking about large vehicles at this time. Six passenger vehicles. Then as a co-running program, we started the little vehicle programs, cookie cutter models. They all started to look alike, the Volkswagens, the little Fiestas, and all those vehicles. That went on as a separate program, as a shortcut to achieve the gasoline mileage. So we had government mandates on safety and emissions hitting us with adding prices to the car. And in every one of these cases, the designer was called upon there to design for function, 100% now, and he was happy to receive that challenge and work in that direction. And then at this period, aerodynamic efficiencies, which were previously thought only to be effective as speeds above 55 miles an hour, were suddenly discovered to be effective around 30, 35 miles an hour. So the full use of wind tunnels were employed, and corners were rounded off in strategic places to start to get aerodynamic efficiencies. Mm-hmm. Now in the 80s, what's happening now is that we do have an emphasis on small cars, and they are achieving the immediate fuel economies. But being an old gray-headed person, in effect, I still have a feeling, and that's why I'm putting it down, that the standard six-passenger family sedan that we're used to in America, and we have the space to do it, are going to come back. They're not going to come back in the big shapes we used to have, but they will be continue to be the smaller shapes, and the Americans will still look for the commodious feeling. And I think the Continentals, the Lincolns, the Cadillac Sevilles are echoing that. Good tailored vehicles, proper size so you're comfortable in it. And then coupled with this, full aerodynamic needs will be recognized, which will mean we may have certain air spoilers at certain times on the roof, or we may have NASA air scoop intakes to stop turbulence. We'll reduce the offset of the metal surfaces to the glass plane so there's less turbulence around the glass surfaces there. And then front-wheel drive, of course, will become more predominant in order to make more full use of the interior of the vehicle while reducing the outside size of the vehicle. And what I've given there is just a brief, cursory overview of some of the things, and to the degree anybody wants to go into detail on it, I can follow it up. Then, as the last items I put on here, one of the things I had mentioned to Doug in last conversation that in the development of vehicles, that the models of 1927 used almost as much sheet metal in covering from side to side as our cars do today. And so I've drawn on these pictures in 1927 the amount of sheet metal it took to go over the hood, down the side of the hood, down to the frame, and back up around the fender on a Model T 1927 model. And then on the next page, I've shown in 1932 that line was reduced a little bit by lowering the hood line. And then in 1940, the fender became a little easier attached to the side of the hood. The side of the hood became less deep. And then in 1949, of course, it indicates that we have efficient use of the sheet metal.
That's really remarkable when you see it.
It may not measure out 100%, but it's a concept.
And it's a pattern that you see developing that normally one wouldn't think about.
And if you were to project this out into the following years, that line started to grow out into contours out here in the fender as it went through, and then they grew up in the fins, and they started waste metal.
Yeah.
So I made a set of these for you and a set of these for Mike Davis.
Okay,
and
very good.
You can turn them up and throw them away if you want. They're just tools.
This would be a good good point to take a look at, and we'll have these. I don't know if we should go over and talk about some of this now.
Well, back in that period, Doug had quite touched on it. I was about 18 years of age, 19, and my total thoughts were, since I wasn't a manager, I was a trainee learning how to do things. My job was not to take and set style at that point, but to learn it and understand it. And so I didn't know basically the philosophy that Gregory was shooting at that time, but I was aware of it. I knew we all liked the idea of trying to get vehicles lower, tried to make body surfaces fit in a little bit better. We knew the future, we thought we knew the future, was to try to put headlights into fenders and ease up the surfaces, make the bumpers integral with the fenders so they just didn't stick out there. And that occupied pretty much the stuff before the war broke out.
Sure. Well, I wonder if maybe we should go through some of the other photographs I've got that I kind of pulled out, use that as a kind of a stimulus, and then we'll get into some of the projects that you worked on in the war.
Fine.
Yeah. I've got some copies of photographs that I pulled out of our photographic files, and I've got them numbered, and I thought we'd just comment and or identify some of these things as we can to help us in our files here. We've got item number one, which is number 13621. Can you identify this individual on here?
That's John Hay, H-A-Y.
H-A-Y. And what does he have over here on these tables?
Those tables are about 4 feet high, and they're modeling tables. He is using a surface gauge to measure the height of a windshield on what appears to be a 1939 Mercury. I think. I'm fairly sure that's... No, yeah. That's where it is, 39 Mercury. This was a 35 Ford. And what he's working on there are quarter scale models. 1/4 inch equals a foot. I'd forgotten we use that size. Mm-hmm. And in the foreground was this 1939
Mercury.
And then background is a blackboard drawing of a full-size automobile.
Mm-hmm.
John Hay is a story himself. He came from Ohio and was quite a good craftsman. And in order to get his job with Ford Motor Company, he built a little model, a four-door convertible model. It was about 12, 13 inches long, and he made it out of tin cans that he hammered together, soldered them together, painted them. The model had full springing, the doors open, the hood open, the headlights lit, the tail lamp open, and he sent that in. And when Mr. Gregory saw that, he got Mr. Hay into our area right away. So Mr. Hay, like the rest of us trainees, in his own profession, was a superb craftsman.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Did he stay in the Stalin?
Yes, he retired here about 6-7 years ago. He's currently living in Algonac. And he is just a superb individual. I can't speak too highly of him. He still may have that little model. And if I ever talk to him, I'll tell him to bring it down. Now that's Zephyr.
And this is photo number two. Picture was taken in June 1938. Anything that particularly
No, except it was taken at the design building, the Triple E building.
Okay.
And the only thing that I'm surprised at, I look at that hood side louver, that leading edge, I'd forgotten they had the Lincoln Zephyr there.
Uh-huh. Photo number three is of the bridge. You want to explain anything about this at all?
The bridge system, Ford Motor Company was far ahead of General Motors, Chrysler, or Briggs with this particular device for aiding and abetting the creation of full-size clay models. And it consists, it was developed by Willis P. Wagner, who is now retired. Willis P. Wagner designed two longitudinal rails that sat parallel with the center line of the vehicle and ran longitudinally from front to rear. And at each end of these two rails were cross surface plates, so that the vehicle was completely surrounded by these metal plates. The two side plates had a little track on them, a little upstanding track. And on this track rolled what we called a bridge, which in reality was a two vertical posts, one on either side of the track, and a crossbeam. So if you could visualize that there's this plate on the floor, a car sitting within that plate area, and this bridge straddles that vehicle. And on this bridge there are 10-inch divider bars that you could put in a measuring stick and measure from these divider bars into the clay model and orient yourself or get any cord that you wanted from that particular model. The bridge had the capability of rolling on these tracks from the front edge of the vehicle to the full aft edge of the vehicle. The bridge scales could be adjusted, and on the track that sat on the floor there are holes located every inch so that every inch increment the bridge could be locked in place. Our competitors, General Motors and Chrysler, used metal surface plates and cut out plywood or masonite templates and fit them into the side of the clay model, and then they scraped down to it. And our system was much faster for doing the original design, and for more importantly, once the design is improved, for getting off the coordinates onto the drafting paper. Long speech.
What or how many of these units might have been in operation at one time?
Before 1941, 241, must have had about 6 or 7 of the bridges were going at that time. And in the background, you can see this, what looks like a wood structure. And that is one of my first design assignments at Ford. And that wood structure was called a viewing platform. And that viewing platform was big enough to ride up over the full-size clay model so that Mr. Gregory and others could climb up on that bridge and look down at that model to see how the line flowed in plan view from the hood to the front door, to the rear door, to the rear fender. And since Mr. Gregory was originally a ship designer, he was especially conscious of the need for flowing lines. Mm-hmm. General Motors didn't quite go that route. They usually had a good line flowing from their rear fender to the rear door, to the front door, but then they broke in plan view the cowl and the hood line, a sharp break inboard. I don't know why they did that. And I'm shuffling some papers here. I know I put those pictures in this book. And there are the pictures of that. There we go. I was patient enough to find it. I think some of the pictures that I brought in, Doug, will be tying with yours.
Okay.
This particular picture, for instance, shows a clay model inside of the bridge that you showed me.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's the photo 12832, and I can leave these with you.
Okay, very good. When we refer to them, we just give them a number.
Okay.
How about this one? It's photo number 4. So it looks like a clay model.
Mm-hmm.
Does it ring any bell?
Sure does. The gentleman in the background over the model is Jay, and I don't know his last name. J.Y., he was formerly a sweeper and expressed a desire to become a clay modeler, and as is with Ford Motor Company, there's always somebody looking out for another person, and he was soon transferred and began clay modeling. Further in the background, again, the little quarter-scale models that we worked on, and usually before you start a full-size model, you would develop it in the quarter scale, and Mr. Edsel Ford or Mr. Gregory or whoever was making the calling the shots said, okay, go ahead and make a full size. Now, what's in the bridge, a full-size clay model, is a Zephyr, and appears to be the late Zephyr, the 39, because you can see the running board area. It may even be a study further on. It could have been a 38 model brought in and really worked in around the doors to see if the body could be brought down flush or the running board could be brought way inboard to eliminate any semblance of a kick out at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And there's that platform back there.
What about photo number 5? Is that?
Can't help with it. It was one of those vehicles that were built before my time. Mm-hmm. Of course, the only thing I really loved on that was the Whippet.
Whippet. Photo 6 is a frame.
A rear engine.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm not familiar with that. It might have been done by Farkas.
Uh-huh. 7 is a panel delivery truck.
No, it had nothing to do with the design of that. I remember doing some schematic drawings which indicated the colors and how to assemble the front end of that, which we made at the design department and sent down to Rouge. No.
Were these photos, would they be outside the building and they were taken out? Did that appear to be right to you?
Sure looks. I'm not...
It looks like the water tower in the back.
Yeah, sure it does. This looks like it was in the front, but this belies... Mm-hmm. I'm not sure the location of that.
8 is from August 1937, the cab over truck.
I didn't do any designing on that, but that was in there when I...
Mm-hmm.
Just about the time I walked in the door. So it was there. I probably didn't... I had nothing to do with it.
Number 9, photo taken in 1930.
No, not familiar with it at all.
Okay. Number 10 is a Zephyr, but it has the running board.
No, it was even the picture was taken before we got there, so I don't know what they would have been exploring on. I'm not sure. I noticed back here this quarter window has what looks like a CV. Control ventilation, but I'm not.
Yeah. Number 11. We looked at this before. The possibility of this being an English car.
Yeah, about that time, the war clouds were gathering over in Europe, and a fellow by the name of V.Y. Talberg, I think, was in Germany, and somewhere between 37, 38, 39. I'm not sure. There was liaison between design need for the German cars. And they'd ship some of the cars over and we would work on the front end of the model. And I don't know whether I worked on this one or another one, but several of us had, there were about 3 or 4 front ends being done simultaneously, and each one of us had a front end to do. This looks like it could have been one of them. Mm-hmm. Although by the date on this, that would have been December 37, I would be only in the design department for a couple, 3 months at the most, I wouldn't have had an assignment like that.
Number 12 is some experimental car.
I have no idea. In fact, I'm surprised. I don't know what a Ford motor ever did like that.
Well, it might have been just something that...
a small model.
It looked like a 110 size, really.
Yes.
And
I know that Mr. E.T. Gregory did a number of roadsters for Edsel prior to the time the department was formed. And at that time, the keeping the wheels separate from the body, doing a little race car, and then enclosing them was prevalent, sort of like this rear cover.
13 is the next photo, showing a mock-up of the seat and the door. I guess my concern here, is this the way that it was done? What was this called?
Well, it wouldn't be called a seating buck, obviously, and I don't know what we use then, but that's the way they were shown. The door panels were usually set up on easels or wood forms and set alongside of either the front or rear seat, which was trimmed in the proposed design. So you could say it was an interior platform mock-up.
Okay. Okay. And we get a couple of photos, I guess, that are related. The gentleman is working in the studio, number 14 and number 21. And you've got 13766. What is this?
I put down designer, as I wrote on mine, designer Bruno Colt sketching for design department circa 1939. In the background is a 1939 Ford, a wooden mobile viewing platform, boards for displaying drawings, and a portion of a clay modeling bridge. The wooden mobile platform was used to look down at the top view of the clay models to ensure the car's contour line flowed smoothly. For example, through the hood, the doors, and the roof quarter panel. Mm-hmm.
And he was with the department
prior to the war years.
Prior to the war.
And his particular Ford was doing grills, front ends of the vehicles.
What about photo 15?
Yes. I'm coming through something here. That brings back good memories for me, because I have other photographs to go with it. Your photograph shows John Major, me, in a smock, working on a full-size blackboard drawing. We call the big boards that held the full-size drawings of automobiles blackboards. The reason that we had painted them black was that the black allowed you to put renderings on top of that board, and the black would recede into the background.
Mm-hmm.
This blackboard would be anywhere from 17 feet to 24 feet, and at the each end were mounted supporting wheels, which were spread out, of course, so the blackboard could be used on both sides. So the blackboard ended up being about 7.5 feet high and could be used on both sides and was faced with plywood. In this particular drawing, the man on the right is Edward A. Martin, and what we're doing here is making a layout of what appears to be a 1939 Mercury.
Mercury.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Full size.
Off to the left is some device that has my curiosity.
Yes, that's called a sweep rack. And it had wheels on the bottom of it, and it set up like a mobile clothes hanger rack. And hanging from this rack on either side are long wooden splines. These splines were about 40 inches in length, and they called them sweeps or splines. Spline, of course, was a one-by-one piece of wood, 4 feet long to 10, 15 feet long, and you could bend these pieces of wood to take on a smooth curve. The sweeps were irregular shapes, about 2 to 3 feet long, giving gentle curves on them for, people refer to them as French curves in the drafting business, for drawing the lines on the models. And then there are the true sweeps. And the true sweeps, again, are 40, 42 inches long. And they are segments of a radius. And you'd get a 40-inch radius, 50-inch radius, and it'd be set up in a series of coverage.
Okay.
And you'd use these full-size pieces, usually made out of wood or plastic or aluminum, to draw.
This kind of relates to a photo that you have.
Yes, and I just wonder if there's a number on the back of this one. The photo that I have is a blackboard drawing being colored in. After a drawing was done on tracing paper, it would be run off onto the blueprint machine and brought back and stapled up to the blackboard, and then the designers would take chalk, large chalk sticks, and color in the salient features and people, passengers that would be on the vehicle, and this would be shown along to management, showing how much room would be for the people. And the drawing I have, the man in the foreground is Tucker Matawick, who later became president of design for RCA Corporation. The middle man is Edward A. Martin, who is my mentor and teacher, and then, of course, myself, John Major.
Good.
And that's the drawing.
That's the completed drawing, and that's
completed
colored drawing. And that's number 16147.
Right.
Okay. The next one I have is number 16. I don't know, how would you describe it?
That's an action photograph of clay modelers at work loading the clay onto a model. Loading the clay meant the raw armature was rolled into this bridge form, set into position with its jacks and locating pins, and the clay ovens would be heated up to a temperature of 140 degrees. Chavon clay was used at that time. It usually came in either a gray-green color or a rust chocolate color. Ford Motor at that time was using the gray-green Chavon clay. And this came in billets of about 10 to 15 pound apiece. These were put into our warming ovens, which at that time, and I have a picture of them back in my book here, they were simply boxes with either light bulbs or heat element strips. And you had to watch the clay very carefully, because once the clay got too hot, it turned liquid, and then the sulfur broke out of it, and it became useless. But when the clay temperature was just right, it was completely malleable in your hand like bread dough just before you bake it. And with this in your hand, you could now start to apply the clay to the clay model by putting it on in thin layers, layer after layer after layer. And after a certain time, your hands toughened up to the heat of the clay and the friction of applying it. And you soon found out your ability as the armature designer was to able to foresee how far the final clay would be. You'd sometimes get clay 6 inches to 8 inches to 9 inches deep on a model as it went from rough clay to finish. So what these gentlemen in this picture are doing again, and they're all over the model. Bob Paulson is the man with the striped shirt on the left. It's the only one I can identify. But I have another photograph that shows that Jimmy Mearns is somewhere around that model. They're putting in the rough clay, and those are hand marks on there rather than tool marks. So the grooves you see on the surface are this hot clay in your hand and the fingers rubbing it off.
Is it possible to sort of estimate how many people might have worked on this and how long it took them to reach this stage?
A lot of the, yes, it is. And it varies. One is your time element. If you have to make ready for a show, you can pour so many more man hours onto it. If you have a lot of leisurely time and the drawings aren't quite done, it will take longer. But usually when we were loading the clay on was put to a task of about 6 people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a rotating thing because it was an ugly job. And so you'd take a crew of 6 guys off of one clay model and say, okay, it's your turn to load the clay on this. And so you'd rotate. So there'd be all the way around the front of the end of the vehicle would take 2 guys, the body would take 2 guys, and then about 2 guys on the rear is the way we worked it. As we got more sophisticated, we stopped claying in the windshield, as I notice on the model. We started to cut in, the model shows the way we got more sophisticated. We cut out wooden templates out of masonite and sank them into the surface since they were flat planes, then brought the clay up to the glass planes.
Mm-hmm.
Time element on this, the armature would have taken about a week and a half to 2 weeks to build. It was made out of wood and hung on either to a metal production frame as being its underlayment, or there would be wood 2x12s that would be the frame to which the armature would be built. So that took about a week and a half to 2 weeks. Loading the clay on would take about a week. Loading the clay on was just not simply making a blob of clay. It was building the clay up to predetermined surfaces, usually set in with templates or some of the points from our bridge. Then from that point on, after you had it loaded and generally roughed in, it would take you about 8-12 weeks to finish up that clay model so that it was ready for paint or shown in its final clay surface moved down with turpentine and silver foil on the moldings and door handles, and the bumpers rolled up.
Mm-hmm.
So elapsed time, 6 to 8 weeks, and 1.5, 10, about 3 months.
3 months. Mm-hmm. Number 17, how can we describe this?
That is an armature that is being torn apart. It was obviously a clay model at one time, and it looks like it was circa 1939 because of that shape on that front fender, and it was either a Ford or a Mercury. And it has been through the shows, and it's no longer needed, so the clay is being stripped off it to be used,
mm-hmm.
put into the machines and remelted again. The wood armature could again be used if they found out that they could rip off the back end and add a new pieces of wood to conform to our new shapes.
Mm-hmm. Who would have constructed this armature?
Our wood shop, and that was underneath the aegis of Jimmy Lynch, who was in charge of our metal/wood shop. And in the wood shop there were now about 10 or 12 people in there, pattern makers, and Johnny A. was now in there, the man I had mentioned previously.
Did this wood have to be of any particular type, or did it make it...
I'm glad you brought that up. No, it didn't. As far as I'm concerned, it could have been just straight wood, lath work, knotted, but not at Ford Motor Company. They had a habit of ordering in number one clear, and that meant no knots in the wood. And all the wood that went underneath in the bulkheads of this was pure, so when they broke up one of these models and they went to truck the wood out, it broke your heart, because you just love to have that piece of wood for a woodway, you know. So yeah, that's just the point. That's
interesting. Number 18, I think we looked at before.
So that's a full-size blackboard drawing of a 1939 Mercury, and it shows all the important vehicles, important look of the vehicle. Now, from this drawing, it could just be shown as a mechanical drawing, or we could color it in to make a full-size color drawing. But it showed the significant outline of the vehicle, its stance, how the bumpers were attached, the fender profiles, the hood profile, the door openings, and then inboard and hidden lines were all the seat movement, the steering wheel, the floor, the drive line. So it's a pretty complete informational drawing.
Number 19, I have a picture of that, and I think I broke down on all the names, and that's why I would like to take the time to thumb through.